A scorching Las Vegas casino, midnight shift, 2016. Hillary Clinton stands messy-haired and makeup-free, embracing Latina housekeepers who erupt in tears. Ay, Dios mío, they cry. La Hillary. This wasn't the robotic candidate America thought it knew. This was someone real, connecting with workers invisible to most politicians. But here's the thing. Almost nobody saw this Hillary. For a decade, journalist Amy Chozick chased Clinton through two presidential campaigns, accumulating moments like these that never quite made it into the narrative. What she discovered wasn't just a story about politics. It was about the impossible space women occupy when they dare to want power, about the media machine that both creates and destroys political figures, and about how we all became complicit in elevating the very forces we claim to fear. Hillary's relationship with journalists resembled a bitter marriage, mutual dependence laced with contempt stretching back to her first lady years. The guys, her almost exclusively male press team, maintained detailed dossiers tracking perceived slights, weaponizing access with military precision. When Chozick wrote about the Clinton Foundation buying a first-class ticket for Natalie Portman's dog, they launched a week-long campaign of angry calls. Hillary herself studied reporters' faces in a meticulously maintained Facebook, not to engage with them, but to avoid mistaking them for actual voters. During rare off-the-record drinks, she delivered soul-crushing assessments of political journalists as gossip peddlers, too dim to understand policy. This mutual distrust created a vicious cycle. Hillary went 84 days without a press conference, feeding negative coverage that reinforced her belief that reporters were out to get her. The response was further restriction, creating what one staffer called a bunker mentality. Veteran journalist Jill Abramson captured the impossible dynamics. You're either hated or you're irrelevant. There was no middle ground for women in this campaign. In Black churches across America, a different Hillary emerged, one who opened services with Psalm 118:24, quoted scripture fluently, and referenced theologian Henry Nguyen. This wasn't performance. Chozick had seen Hillary's well-worn Bible on the 2008 campaign plane, margins filled with notes. Hillary once spoke openly about faith. Her 1993 speech on America's crisis of meaning led to a New York Times Magazine cover story titled Saint Hillary. The subsequent mockery drove her underground. Unlike Republican candidates awkwardly flaunting rehearsed verses, Hillary's faith ran deep. You could have been a Methodist pastor in another life, people said. This spiritual core emerged powerfully during Flint's water crisis. At House of Prayer Missionary Baptist Church, Hillary spoke with moral clarity. Clean water is not optional. It is not a luxury. What happened in Flint is immoral. This was Saint Hillary, the passionate Sunday school teacher awakened by Methodist belief that the ultimate test of a moral society is the kind of world that it leaves to its children. Yet this authentic, spiritually grounded Hillary remained hidden from most voters. Her strategists prioritized policy papers over personal connection, failing to recognize Americans sought someone who understood their pain. In a catastrophic miscalculation, Brooklyn strategists dubbed Trump their Pied Piper, a showman who could drive out Republican moderates. We need to be elevating the Pied Piper candidates, read an early DNC memo, explicitly naming Trump. They positioned him as the Republican face through targeted media placements and provided opposition research to journalists. The strategy reflected a fundamental misreading of the electorate. While Hillary's team focused on Trump's offensive comments, they missed how his economic populism resonated with voters feeling left behind. Bill Clinton recognized Trump's genius in an Instagram election, delivering bite-sized solutions while Hillary offered detailed policy proposals. Trump's promises to bring back manufacturing jobs and drain the swamp connected emotionally in ways Hillary's 12-point plans never could. The strategy reflected a fundamental misreading of the electorate. While Hillary's team focused on Trump's offensive comments, they missed how his economic populism resonated with voters feeling left behind. Bill Clinton recognized Trump's genius in an Instagram election, delivering bite-sized solutions while Hillary offered detailed policy proposals. Trump's promises to bring back manufacturing jobs and drain the swamp connected emotionally in ways Hillary's 12-point plans never could. Despite Trump's persistent poll numbers, the campaign continued elevating him through October, dismissing his support as a summer fling. Their opposition research on Trump was surprisingly thin at 157 pages compared to thousands on Jeb Bush. While Hillary spent August 2016 raising $143 million at Hampton's fundraisers, Trump held rallies in economically distressed communities. As Matthew Dowd warned, Hillary has built a large tanker ship and she's about to confront Somali pirates. Hillary's consultants rebranded struggling voters as everyday Americans, inadvertently echoing Walmart's slogan. The cynical press corps quickly turned everydays into insider shorthand for carefully selected event attendees. Campaign events were meticulously orchestrated roundtables. Mental health in New Hampshire, opioids in Ohio, small business in Iowa. Hillary sat at horseshoe-shaped tables surrounded by pre-vetted participants instructed to call her Hillary. Sessions devolved into policy seminars, with Clinton reciting inequality statistics while furiously scribbling in her leather notebook. The disconnect was striking. After 4 years meeting world leaders, she seemed genuinely shocked by the opioid crisis. The campaign tested 84 replacement slogans. While Trump ate KFC on his gold-plated 757, Hillary couldn't shake perceptions of wealthy elite isolation, reinforced by her separate charter plane from the press corps. At a September 2016 LGBT fundraiser, Hillary categorized Trump supporters into three groups: loyal Republicans, economically abandoned voters, and the deplorables, the racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, you name it. She claimed half of Trump's supporters fit that description, regretting the statement by the next day. The deplorables line exemplified what brown loafers called the gaffe matrix, damning statements aides anticipate but lack courage to stop, like Michelle Obama's first time in my adult life or Romney's 47%, Hillary's senior aides heard her test the baskets analogy repeatedly at private events but never intervened. The comment exposed a fundamental contradiction. While portraying Trump as embodying a system where the rich and powerful stick it to everybody else, she averaged $150,000 an hour at exclusive gatherings where she tested lines like, "I stand between you and the apocalypse." Brooklyn treated 70-year-old Bill like a problematic child. He splintered off on bus tours to places Hillary wouldn't go: North Florida, Eastern Ohio, Iowa, rural Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, trying to reach white working-class voters who'd elected him. He used the Zulu greeting, "Sawubona," "I see you," to explain an enormous number of people feel like they're not seen. His most consequential action came when he stepped onto Attorney General Loretta Lynch's airplane on a Phoenix tarmac for 20 minutes, a meeting that would force Lynch to recuse herself from the email investigation and give James Comey greater authority. The Russian hack gave Brooklyn a perfect villain. Hillary had mocked Putin in paid speeches and now sounded Reagan-esque. "Putin will eat your lunch." When Trump publicly encouraged Russian hacking, Russia, if you're listening, he didn't know Russian hackers had already phished Podesta's password in March. The WikiLeaks releases created an ethical nightmare. Times columnist David Leonhardt later called it the media's worst mistake in 2016. Chazik reflected, "Nothing hurt worse than colleagues calling me a de facto instrument of Russian intelligence. The worst part was they were right." On election night, Hillary's response encapsulated her decades-long struggle. "I knew it. I knew this would happen to me. They were never going to let me be president." The next morning, Hillary wore purple, eyes betraying recent tears. The female press corps looked broken. Chazik realized what the decade-long chase had cost: the fights, postponing a baby, becoming an unwitting Russian agent. Hillary's loss represented cultural rejection, the careful, qualified woman losing to her bombastic male opponent. The tragedy? In trying to become what America wanted, Hillary lost the qualities that might have made her president.